I used to walk around and say, I don't judge anyone except for Christians.
I remember a magistrate saying, you're not listening to anything we're trying to do, you're going to prison, son.
People are mysteries and also infinitely valuable in that way.
Then they tell you you'll probably be dead within 27 months.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Natasha Moore.
And I'm Justine Toe.
8th of March, 1917. The world is in the throes of a brutal war, and tens of thousands of people gather in the centre of the Russian capital, Petrograd. They're on strike, they say, for bread and peace. Banners are raised high, feed the children of the defenders of the motherland. This day marked the beginning of the Russian Revolution. 4 days later, the Tsar abdicated, and women were given the right to vote. Because the protesters that started the Russian Revolution were not male workers, they were mostly women. The governor of the city described the crowd, ladies from society, lots more peasant women, student girls, and compared with earlier demonstrations, not many workers.
And because of those women, March 8 is now the date we use to celebrate International Women's Day. It's a day of action and also a time to remember and celebrate the achievement of women in all areas of life, social, economic, cultural, and political. So we thought we'd bring you a few stories of women who've changed the world, women we personally admire, who are also women of faith. We'll look at the life of the woman who basically professionalised nursing, a missionary's wife, who was really a missionary in her own right, and a writer who some say started the American Civil War. Women have played these huge roles in major historical events. They've been the drivers of economic progress, social change, justice. Some we know of. But the impact of many, if they're not missing outright from the pages of history, are often written in the margins. This is something that really stood out to me as we were making our documentary, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined. And yes, it is coming out soon, we promise.
Very soon, very soon. So one of the women that we got to feature was Harriet Beecher Stowe. We need a bit of backstory for this one.
I can't accomplish a goddamn thing of any human meaning or worth until we cure ourselves of slavery and end this pestilential war. And whether any of you or anyone else knows it, I know I need this. This amendment is that cure.
That was from the movie Lincoln, a biopic about Abraham Lincoln, one of the most revered figures in US history, sometimes called the Great Emancipator. And the 13th Amendment, the abolition of slavery, is his great legacy. But Lincoln himself pointed to someone else as having stirred the anti-slavery sentiment that led to the American Civil War. That someone else was Harriet Beecher Stowe, author of the novel Uncle Tom's Cabin. The story goes that when Lincoln met Stowe in 1863, he said, "So this is the little lady who made this big war." Harriet Beecher Stowe was a very devout Christian woman who became an abolitionist. Uncle Tom's Cabin was, for a lot of Americans, their first real glimpse into what life was really like for enslaved people, and especially for women. What was most affecting for a lot of readers was just scene after scene of families being torn apart, mothers and children separated, and the devastation of that. If you read it now, it's still very much of its time. There's lots of racial stereotypes that seem shocking to us. But it had a huge impact in turning people against the institution of slavery. Here's Professor Catherine Breckus from Harvard Divinity School on why the book made such an impact.
Uncle Tom's Cabin was the best-selling book in America before the Civil War, with the exception of the Bible. The Bible is the only book that sold more copies. And it's clear that Stowe reached a lot of people through her story and that she galvanized a lot of anti-slavery sentiment. Part of the reason for that is that in some ways it's a very revolutionary book. Uncle Tom's Cabin features two characters who are Christ figures. One is Uncle Tom, a slave, and the other is little Eva, who's a child. And this was a very radical statement to make, that the salvific power in Christianity comes from the weak, it comes from children, it comes from the oppressed. She did not believe that Christianity was about the power that ministers had or that elites had, but that the power of Christianity lay in the lowly people.
Maybe the thing that I find most impressive about Harriet Beecher Stowe is that she sat down to write Uncle Tom's Cabin in the first place simply because her sister-in-law wrote her this letter and said to her, hey, if I could write the way that you can, I would write something that will make this whole nation feel what an accursed thing slavery is. And so she did. It just amazes me that someone could pretty much go, this is wrong and I'm going to write a book that will change it. And then she did.
Just like that. This is how you change the world, ladies.
I guess so.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. In our documentary, we interviewed Professor Jeffrey Cox, an expert on the history of religion and Christianity from the University of Iowa. And one of the things we talked about was the way that the experience of women has been confined to the margins of history. Here he is.
Well, yes. I mean, it's almost impossible to persuade people that the missionary movement was a majority women's movement, not just in the late 19th century when they began organizing and sending unmarried women, but from the first. I really haven't found an example of a married missionary couple where the woman and later the many daughters they had when they came of age didn't start teaching women and giving informal medical care and having classes. This happened all around the world.
Now, Cox says women missionaries were doing the work alongside the men, but weren't recognised at all. I was thinking about this when I was doing a segment in the documentary on the Serampore Trio. They were these three guys, William Carey, William Ward, Joshua Marshman, and they went to India as Christian missionaries, but didn't end up actually converting many people. But they had this huge impact nonetheless. They campaigned against human rights abuses, the killing of lepers, of baby girls, and this incredibly horrible, I'm sorry to say, practice called sati, which is this cultural tradition of burning widows on their dead husband's pyre. They also established free schools for Indian children, regardless of caste, for girls as well as boys. And they also used their political influence to force the British East India Company to allocate a portion of their profits to local education. And this means that you had state-funded education in India before it was introduced in England. So this trio, they weren't just interested in saving souls. They were invested in the material welfare of people right now. They basically drove economic development, educational reform, and social change in this part of India. But the thing is, the Serampore Trio wasn't really a trio. Joshua Marshman's wife, Hannah Marshman, was also in India, working right alongside these men. If Carey was the father of the Serampore mission, Hannah Marshman was its matriarch.
Yeah, there isn't a lot written about her, is there? What could you actually find out about Hannah Marshman?
Well, before we get to her sterling historical achievements, I just want to establish that she had 12 children.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, exactly. She raised the surviving six. But she went through the process of birth 12 times. 12! Oh, my gosh.
Okay. You're a mum. You appreciate this one.
No, I do. I do appreciate this. So as well as raising the six children that were in Serampore, she actually took charge of William Carey's four juvenile delinquent sons as well. Even though he was the father of the Serampore mission, he was not really a father to his own children. He kind of neglected their care. And his wife, Dorothy, was quite mentally unstable, so she wasn't able to look after them as well. But I want to stress that it's not as though she just looked after the house and the family, okay? When I was talking about how the trio kicked off an education revolution, she was leading the charge, especially when it came to girls. Like so many other women who are the great unsung heroes of history, others got a lot of the glory for a lot of the work that Hannah Marshman did behind the scenes. I mean, she was an absolute boss. It is absolutely clear that the whole mission at Serampore would have fallen apart had it not been for her commitment, her drive, her resourcefulness, even the way that she contributed money to the work of the mission and ran the finances of the whole place. And she did all of this without having any female role models to look up to. She was the first female missionary in India. She carved her own path. She saw what needed to happen and then set about making it happen. And all at a time when the Baptist Missionary Society didn't recognise female missionaries. They just saw them as missionary wives. But Hannah Marshman's life shows her as a missionary in her own right.
Do you reckon she was a bit bitter about the men getting all the credit for everything she did?
Well, we look back now and recognise that she was really hard done by. But whether or not she was really cross about it, we just don't know. All we do know is that she kept working and she outlived all the men. I mean, she was in India for 47 years and only William Carey came close at 41 years. I think when someone keeps working like that, tirelessly, you know they're not doing it for the recognition.
One woman who I really, really, really wanted us to include in the documentary, but who didn't quite make the cut, not because she's not awesome, but, you know, we couldn't do everything, was Florence Nightingale. People might have heard of her as the woman who almost single-handedly revolutionised the field of nursing. She made it a rigorous and a respected profession, which it certainly wasn't either of those things when she started out. But one of the things that I most admire about her is that she came from this really upper-class family and her father supported her education and sort of wanted her to make something of herself. But her mother and her sister were really opposed to her going into nursing. It was, you know, seen as a very low occupation and quite disreputable. And they kind of wanted her to spend her time doing the things that wealthy society women were meant to do. Things like embroidery and driving out in a carriage and writing letters and making social calls. And she was just having none of it. She wanted to do something really meaningful with her time. She wanted to make use of what she saw as her God-given gifts in what she saw as her God-given vocation of caring for the sick. She actually wrote this short but incredibly powerful book called Cassandra. I came across it a few years ago, and it's this profound protest against the forced idleness of Victorian women. So it's not very well known at all, but it's this electrifying read. So if you will indulge me, I want to just read a little bit from it, okay?
Just a little bit, Natasha.
Okay, so she's writing about how women's intellects and ambitions and so on are stifled by not being allowed to do anything. Here's what she says. To have no food for our heads, no food for our hearts, no food for our activity, is that nothing? If we have no food for the body, how all the newspapers talk of it, with a paragraph headed in great capital letters, death from starvation. But suppose one were to put a paragraph in the Times, death of thought from starvation, or death of moral activity from starvation, how people would laugh. One would think we had no heads nor hearts by the total indifference of the public towards them. Our bodies are the only things of any consequence. Jesus Christ raised women above the condition of mere slaves, mere ministers to the passions of the man, raised them by his sympathy to be ministers of God. He gave them moral activity, but the age must give them the means to exercise this moral activity, must give them intellectual cultivation, spheres of action.
She sounds quite scary, actually, in a really cool way. So what did she do to rebel against this life of forced inactivity?
Well, for starters, she refused to marry. There was this guy who chased her for kind of 9 years, and it's not that she didn't love him, and he was one of the most kind of eminent men in England, but she just felt that she wouldn't be able to do her work if she did say yes to him.
Wow.
So she insisted on training as a nurse against the wishes of her family, and her real chance to use her training came with the Crimean War in 1854. So Britain and a bunch of other countries were fighting Russia, and something like 10 times as many men were dying in the hospitals than on the battlefield because the conditions were just so terrible. So Nightingale got herself sent out there with a bunch of nuns and other volunteer nurses and started turning the place around. So she improves hygiene. She does things like getting doctors to wash their hands. She gets the sewers flushed out. She improves ventilation. And whether directly or indirectly, she reduces the death rate in this war hospital from 42% to 2%. So we have this very sentimental image of Florence Nightingale as the lady with the lamp. You might have heard this kind of angelic nurse figure who's walking the wards through the night, comforting the men. And it's not untrue exactly, but it does leave out a lot. She was not just about kind of individual care, but about systems and policy and reform. She had these very big picture concerns.
You know, that makes me really angry.
Why?
Well, I mean, I'm really glad she did all that she did, but I'm really angry that no one knows. Well, I'm really angry that I don't even know about that. I've absolutely imbibed that image of her as this woman stroking the fevered brow of the very brave soldier who gave his life on the battlefield. And I don't want to diminish that kind of care, but I just think it's such a shame that we have only looked at that portrait of her and neglected the other parts of her life, which was, you know, she didn't take no for an answer. She was really smart. She was committed to this calling that she felt God had put on her life. We shouldn't neglect that. And I can't help but feel that if she was a man, we would talk about all those other big picture concerns and we wouldn't talk about the caring aspect of his life.
And it's very much that's the female stereotype that was acceptable more or less at the time. And this has been true for the nursing profession, you know, since then as well, that we feminize it and therefore, you know, nurses are paid less than they should be, that kind of thing. Yeah, this is a kind of ongoing problem, actually. Mm. So she does do a lot of things that at the time and still today actually are seen as quite masculine things to do. So after the war, she becomes a leading expert on health. The government was always consulting her on things. She worked like crazy. She used to get up at 5 a.m. and write for 12 hours a day, writing letters to campaign for better medical training and for more humane laws around prostitution. She was very influential on that. She was the first female member of the Royal Statistical Society. So she was just a bit of a force of nature, really.
That's incredible. And she believed that God had called her to do all this?
Yes, this is really clear from her diaries and the things that she wrote. She was not super orthodox in her beliefs. She was often critical of the church. But she had this real personal devotion to Christ throughout her life. There's this story that is told about her when she was looking after a dying prostitute. And this young woman was terrified that she was going to hell. And she says to Nightingale, "Pray God that you may never be in the despair that I'm in at this time." And Nightingale says to her, "Oh, my girl, are you not now more merciful than the God that you think you're going to? Yet the real God is far more merciful than any human creature ever was or can ever imagine." From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Natasha Moore and Justine Toe.
Our documentary, For the Love of God, How the Church is Better and Worse Than You Ever Imagined, will be coming out very soon. So please go to our website and sign up for our director's pass. Stay tuned for a release date. You can find us on fortheloveofgodproject.com.
Hannah Marshman, Harriet Beecher Stowe and Florence Nightingale are just a few of the incredible women we came across during the making of our documentary. If you want to listen to this episode again or hear more from us, do go to our website, publicchristianity.org, or look us up wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating or review.
Next week.
Like, you see these beautiful images of Hubble, but really it's like this super searing hot gas that's flying at super fast speeds across vast amounts of space. And like, you wouldn't want to be there because you would be gone in a millisecond, right? And then, but they look beautiful.